Welcome to Writer's Voice, where the conversation goes deeper. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Both our guests today have written books about aging. Later in the show, we'll air an archived interview with Dr. Andrew Weil about his book, Healthy Aging. But first, in our youth-oriented culture, menopause is often treated like an illness. But my first guest, Judy Norsegian, says it's just a normal part of a woman's life.
It's an important aspect of our life to consider in its normal context and to recognize that some of these fluctuations and changes are normal, are natural, and they don't necessarily require enormous interventions.
Norsegian is director and a longtime member of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. Those are the folks who've been putting out the Our Bodies, Ourselves books since the early 1970s. The books are concerned with women's health throughout the life cycle, but the collective decided now was time to focus on one aspect of that cycle. Their new book is Our Bodies, Ourselves, Menopause. Judy Norsegian, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to join you.
Now, I've almost grown up on the Our Bodies, Ourselves series, and I imagine you too.
Well, yes, I was a young woman when I joined this group. It was back in 1971, and the very first newsprint edition was out already, and I became part of the group. We incorporated in 1972 when we put out the first Simon & Schuster edition in 1973, and last year, the eighth edition of the so-called Bible for Women's Health came out with a hot pink cover, and over the years, people have said, why don't you do some single-topic books? They'd be smaller, easier to carry around. You could go into more depth, and we decided to do that with Simon & Schuster, beginning with the menopause book, and then next year, we'll have Our Bodies, Ourselves, Pregnancy and Birth. And who knows after that? One of the things we're well aware of is that many people look for the information about health and sexuality on the internet and through other electronic media. So we're exploring other ways of getting out good information. And we see that as more critical than ever. Though there's more material around and more books out there, much of it is commercially driven. Much of it is about getting you to buy a product. And it's not always grounded in good evidence, good research, and the real experiences of women. And as you probably know, the hallmark of our books is the inclusion of women's personal experiences as well as the information. And sometimes the information is controversial, so you have to sift through it and decide what's best for you because there isn't always a clear answer.
Yes, and also of a very inclusionary way of looking at the issues, not excluding people based on the kinds of prejudices that you often do see in books. I mean, it's rare that you'll see a book, for example, on menopause that talks about sex between lesbians.
Yes, we are inclusive in terms of making sure the voices of women with disabilities, women of color, women who are of different, you know, even women who are slightly beyond menopause, so that we can have the advantage of seeing how they look back and reflect upon their experiences. And certainly, of course, women who are gay, lesbian, transsexual, transgendered, bisexual, those are important experiences to include as well.
Now, you know, I've always been curious, how did the Boston Women's Health Book Collective get together?
Well, our origins are described at our website, ourbodiesourselves.org, and basically the beginning was a workshop at one of the early women's liberation conferences held in the spring of 1969 at Emmanuel College in Boston. It's quite a long story and a very interesting one, and the women originally did not have the idea that they would produce a book, but it really came out organically from their meetings, and one of the things we really support and endorse is the idea of women getting together and discussing these issues in small groups. That's one of the best ways to learn, share information, and help sort through the various controversies that we're confronted with. And in Our Bodies, Ourselves, Menopause, we do face a lot of those. The question of hormones, whether you can, should, ought to take hormones for menopausal discomfort. Some women have severe hot flashes that don't lend themselves to alternative approaches. Some of these things do work, like yoga or herbal approaches or changes in diet. Sometimes simply getting more exercise and getting a better night's sleep helps. Menopause does produce sleep disruptions for some women.
Well, I'd like to actually get into all of those things in a little bit more depth on each one. I have a whole set of questions about them.
Sure.
But I wonder if you could first define for us what menopause is, because, you know, I was surprised to find out that I've been wrong for most of my life, and I think I'm a pretty educated health consumer, about what menopause is. So tell us what it is.
The narrow definition of menopause is simply having gone a full year without menstruating. And most women do fall in that category. When you've gone a full year, you haven't menstruated, you are highly unlikely to menstruate again. You will not be able to get pregnant again, at least by ordinary means. And you are past the menopause. You will not ovulate anymore, and you sometimes experience changes, physical changes, but not always. That's the most interesting thing about menopause, is that it's not universally experienced the same way. Some women pass through this period without one hot flash, without any disruption, and the only reason they know they're through menopause is that they've had all these months without a period. Other women have quite a host of disruptive experiences. Whether or not we need medical interventions, whether or not we have to view menopause as a medicalized experience, is something that's been debated lately. And of course, we take the view that menopause is a normal, natural life transition. It doesn't need to be medicalized, although we might want medications or interventions if we're having a hard time. So it's an important aspect of our life to consider in its normal context, and to recognize that some of these fluctuations and changes are normal, are natural, and they don't necessarily require enormous interventions.
And they can go on for a long time before women reach menopause.
Yes, hot flashes can occur in your 30s or 40s and well before you start seeing menstrual disturbances and before you skip your periods, before you have sometimes erratic bleeding patterns. Sometimes women bleed a lot or they don't bleed at all. Sometimes they just start bleeding less and less for each period. There are enormous variations in how we go through menopause. There are also women who have early onset menopause. They may, for a variety of reasons, some of them may be genetic, some of them may be environmentally induced. We're beginning to look at those issues as well. They may simply start to experience menopause at a very young age. There are those who have sudden menopause because of surgical reasons. They may have had their ovaries removed, they may have had ovarian cancer, for example, or they may have had radiation or chemotherapy, and that can affect ovarian function. Anything that abruptly stops production of estrogen in the ovaries, and the most common form of estrogen we produce in the ovaries is estradiol, this can start to bring on menopause, and when it's sudden, usually you have some pretty significant experiences and discomforts, and that's why many women who go through surgical menopause do take some kind of a medication or intervention in order to weather that transition.
So the transition itself is where there may be the need to take some kind of replacements. But you say that...
Well, wait a minute. I want to stop you there because okay. We don't use the term replacement anymore.
That's right.
We use the term hormone treatment or therapy, but we don't use that HRT, hormone replacement therapy, because the idea that you have to replace it is really a mistaken notion, particularly around menopause. When you're younger and you have a surgical menopause, you may want to use that idea of replacement because you had this sudden jolt to your body. But in general, we don't use the term replacement.
And actually, I was surprised to find out that women do continue to produce some form of estrogen even after menopause. Tell us about that.
Yes. Our adrenal glands and also adipose tissue, fat tissue, has androgens and that get converted to a weaker form of estrogen called estrone. And for some women, we believe that the production of this weaker form of estrone may ease the transition. It's so interesting that some women sail through menopause with very little physical disruption, and it could be that the estrone levels are at such, and the estrone's functioning in such a way that a woman does not have these hot flashes and very serious symptoms. Well, I will say, I don't want to use the term symptoms. One thing that women do experience around the time of menopause, not all women, but it's quite common, is a loss of lubrication in the vagina and a loss of elasticity, the thinning of the vaginal wall, and this can interfere with sexual intercourse. It can become more painful because of this dryness. And there are certainly some lubricants that are available over the counter, and some of them don't have parabens or phthalates in them, and these substances we're increasingly trying to avoid in all personal care products if we're attuned to the environmental risks that's are out there now and being documented more thoroughly.
Why don't you say what they are for our listeners who may not
know
that?
Well, you know, for example, there are some commercial products such as Astroglide and Replens that have worked well to lubricate the vagina, but they do contain parabens, and I hope that those manufacturers will someday think of a way to produce these products without those particular substances. There are other commercial products available on the internet and in health food stores that don't contain any parabens.
And what's wrong with parabens and phthalates?
Well, they are associated with a host of physical health problems, and I would refer your listeners to the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org, or the Collaborative on Health and the Environment for more information. There's actually a wonderful report they produce called Skin Deep. And in Skin Deep, you see a rather thorough discussion of the various substances and chemicals that are put in personal care products and alternatives that you can use that accomplish the same thing but without exposing you to many of these chemicals that are not conclusively causing the health problems that they're associated with, but as we do more studies, they are increasingly more and more associated with them. And it's this association that becomes something all of us should be concerned about. When it comes to the environment, we're not going to get many studies that prove inconclusively cause and effect. We have to look at the aggregate. We have to look at the big picture, and this is where the precautionary principle of public health comes in, where we have to basically try to do no harm when we've got a body of evidence that suggests just, you know, exposing ourselves to these chemicals, these substances, whether it's in our personal care products or in the environment or, you know, whether it's spraying crops or, you know, using pesticides. These are all critical issues that have to be studied more carefully.
And just to continue that, and briefly that digression, just today in the New York Times, it was a shocking report. Girls and even boys were entering puberty even at preschool ages.
Yes, they were developing breasts very early on, and other signs of puberty that usually you don't see in very young children.
And that was because?
Well, one of the things that we're very well aware of now is that many of the plastics that have gotten into the environment, they're in the waterways, they're in the air we breathe sometimes, that these plastics, especially when they vaporize, they can be ingested in all manner. We know that they function like weak estrogens. They can lock into estrogen receptor cells, and they may, in fact, produce this precocious puberty issue. It's very difficult to control one's exposure. You can do a certain amount by simply trying to avoid the saturated fats in commercially produced beef, for example. They feed most of the cattle in this country quite a bit of estrogen, and that can be a substantial way of ingesting estrogen in the human body. If you get hormone-free beef, if you can afford it, that's one way to avoid that particular means of ingestion. But it's very difficult to avoid the many types of plastics that are out there and the fact that they're ubiquitous. And young children do show levels in their bloodstream as adults do. This reminds me of the studies done by the federal government that showed that 95% of Americans have PFOA, perfluorooctanoic acid, in their bloodstreams. And this is something that has been emitted off of Teflon pans, for example, and in part because DuPont did not use the safest manufacturing process that would keep the Teflon from coming off the pan and into the food. Now, we know that PFOA is not a good thing. We don't want to be putting it in the human body. We have no idea what the long-term effects of this level of exposure might be, but it's pretty ubiquitous. We'll never be able to do a really well-designed controlled trial because everyone's affected, but
you can be
sure that DuPont was fined $12.5 million at the end of last year, and they have to conduct a public education campaign as well, but that doesn't undo the damage that was done.
Right, and, you know, actually there was a brother and a sister, referring back to the creams that you were talking about that started this digression, who picked up testosterone from their father's skin cream that their father put on. So I think the point to make out of this that you do make in your book is that these hormones that are in creams, in lubricants, you know, really can operate at very, very low levels of exposure.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is a very important issue. It's something that we raise even in Our Bodies Are Self-Menopause, but at our website we have many more materials and articles that your listeners might be interested in, and we link to these wonderful environmental organizations that are trying to put a curb on the pollution, on the exposure to toxic substances that seems only to be on the rise.
Right. Well, back to menopause then. You have a list of the common signs of menopause, and, you know, I do understand you're not medicalizing. You make it very clear that you don't want to medicalize what is a natural condition, but there are some signs, as you pointed to, some of the ones that include vaginal dryness or include hot flashes. What are some of the other ones, some uncomfortable things that people have to deal with or may have to deal with, and what can they do about it that's not medical?
Well, the truth is not many things are proven to be directly associated to menopause. The sleep disruption is one, and we've talked about the others. However, things happen around the time of menopause that are partly a result of aging, partly they happen then just because that's when we're experiencing them, but they're not shown to be directly related to the menopausal transition. Some women around this point in their lives start seeing the cholesterol levels rise, and we do cover that because that's an area where women are being told to take statin drugs in many cases when they're unnecessary. If you do not have active heart disease or diabetes, simply having an elevated cholesterol level is not necessarily a good reason to take statin drugs that lower these levels. There are no well-designed trials that show mortality benefit from taking these drugs. That's for this group of women. But on the other side, there are lots of studies that show the harms of statin drugs, the memory loss, the brain fog, the loss of balance, the loss of the muscle atrophy, the kidney damage. We even know that our former Surgeon General, Everett Koop, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about why he went off his statin drugs, because the quality of life factors can be as important as anything else. But we talk about the fact that not only is this an important question because women are taking a drug that might harm them while it doesn't help them, but we use it as an opportunity to educate our readers about the very substantial and inappropriate influence of the pharmaceutical industry over our ideas about drugs and whether we should take them, as well as the prescribing practices of our physicians. The drug industry is doing a tremendous amount to influence physicians to use drugs, often in a less than evidence-based fashion. And that's why we point to the literature, point to the evidence, and encourage our readers to take a much more careful look at all of these issues.
Also, even hormone treatment itself has gone through a lot of ups and downs. Talk about the WHI study. What was that? What did it find?
Well, the Women's Health Initiative was an enormous study, set of studies, really, that concluded that particularly for purported heart health benefits, it made no sense to take estrogens. And that was one of the reasons many women got on estrogens, is that they were hitting the midlife and their physician said, you know, this will protect your heart. And in fact, that study showed us not only doesn't protect the heart, it actually can cause heart problems. So it was very important in that sense. Also showed an increased risk of blood clots, of stroke, and of breast cancer. And that said, one must say that the increased risk was small and that some women do stand to benefit, particularly from short-term use of hormones if they really need to, if they're having a really disruptive experience. And it's, I think the conclusion shouldn't be never touch a hormone. It should be only use hormones if you really stand to benefit, if you really need them. And the Women's Health Initiative did, in fact, produce much less use of estrogens, although it looks like the gynecologists in this country have been urging women to get back on estrogens much more frequently. There's also a very interesting debate about bioidentical hormones. These are very similar to the commercial estrogens that you can get through the drugstore, but they're made from, you know, soy products, sweet potatoes, whatever, natural vegetable sources, and they have a similar effect in the body, and for some women, they seem to be tolerated much better. You can compound them at different amounts, and that's part of the issue. You don't have a standard amount that you have to purchase. You also find that some women seem to tolerate them better than the conventional estrogen products. Now, there are no good studies that say bioidentical hormones are safer and more effective than regular estrogens, and that's important that we all understand that, even though many women report doing much better on bioidentical hormones that are compounded properly than they do on the conventional commercial estrogen products. So this is one area women essentially experiment to figure out what works best for them.
And what about some of the herbs like black blue
cohosh? Black cohosh is one of the very few products that's been shown to be somewhat effective, and their studies are a little bit inconclusive, but they're ongoing, and it looks like there probably is some efficacy here. So women are trying black cohosh and other kinds of mixed preparations. But originally we thought that evening primrose oil and ginseng and some other products like those were effective in terms of treating hot flashes. But studies that were well-designed didn't show these to be effective.
You know, another aspect of your book that I really like is you talk a lot about attitude. I mean, there's even a case in the book where, you know, you have some women who are saying, well, I used to be cold all the time, and they thank their hot flashes for the fact that they get some warmth now.
Yes, that is pretty funny. Many women are happy to have these flushes, and they also see them as part of this menopausal zest experience. Many women find they have new energy, new interests. You know, they're not going to get pregnant anymore, so they actually have renewed interest in sex. And on the other hand, some women lose libido altogether, and they're wondering what's going on because they still have a partner, they still like their partner, and they're wondering why suddenly there's just no sex drive. And these are things that are addressed in the book, and they're really, you know, there's no one solution for anyone. But it's also true that sometimes we change our responses to the same stimuli that used to turn us on when we just looked at someone. Sometimes it takes more holding, hugging, touching, and then the arousal happens a little bit more slowly and gradually, but nonetheless it's very satisfying. One just has to be more creative and more open to new ways of being sexual. Doesn't mean it's any less exciting, it's just different.
And isn't that true for men as well? I mean,
oh yes, men have their own set of issues that happen around the male climacteric that are very interesting, and when you combine women's issues with men's issues, it's really important that there be some creative solutions developed
around sexuality.
Yeah.
We're talking with Judy Norsegian about our bodies, ourselves, menopause. Could you say a little bit more about sexuality? What are, if people can deal with a vaginal dryness by using some good things? Then
yes, you know, women even use olive oil. You know, several women have said that's the easiest thing. I don't have to go out and buy something special. You know, my partner doesn't mind it. You know, some people really love olive oil, actually, especially when there's oral sex. The other thing is that there's a use-it-or-lose-it phenomenon in most cases, and if you maintain your sexual activity, sometimes you find that these problems actually are less and less.
You have a great example about somebody who gave their mother or grandmother a vibrator and found it after they died. I don't know if they were in their 80s or 90s, and found that it had been found it on their nightstand, well used.
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
Well, you know, there are women who've told us they've had their first orgasm in their 50s or 60s. And, you know, sometimes they were still with a partner, sometimes not. But it's wonderful to realize that one can discover new things about your sexuality well into our late years. It's not something that comes and goes. And that is one of the myths about menopause, is that suddenly you're over the hill and you're no longer a sexual human being. Certainly not true, and some women have their best sex after menopause.
Talk also about depression and how much of that may be biologically caused, how much of that may have to do with the view of older women in our society.
Well, there's no question as we hit menopause, we also confront sometimes more than ever societal attitudes towards aging, which are largely negative, and we need to surround ourselves with people and colleagues and friends who don't, or who are trying to resist these stereotypes, you know, that you're old and you're somehow not attractive anymore. You know, one of the things it does is it makes us feel like we have to dye our hair or use more makeup or engage in plastic surgery. More midlife women are seeking breast implants and seeking out surgery that has some fairly significant side effects and health, and actually say risks and medical problems that can result. And there's a great irony here that we do these things to make our lives better, and sometimes they make our lives a whole lot worse. But the pressures one experiences to remain young, to look a certain way, to not put on a few more pounds, when in fact sometimes during menopause those few extra pounds help you have fewer hot flashes because you're going to have more estrogen produced. There's an irony that we feel these pressures, and it's difficult to swing that around and say, you know, I'm a full, talented human being. I've got a lot left to give to my family, my community, and I'd like to put my energies into doing things that are a lot of fun. And maybe that is adorning yourself in, you know, a certain way. And I know a woman who got a tattoo in her menopausal years, and it was part of her expression of moving into a new era. But it really should be something that comes from within you, not from, you know, some sense of a should, pressures from the outside that you're not going to be attractive or you're not going to be desirable if you don't do all of these things. And I think cosmetic surgery and weight loss dieting that goes over the board in terms of denying your body essential nutrients, those can be serious things that we have to really guard against.
And as you point out in your book, and also have some suggestions for exercise and weight-bearing exercise can
sure.
be maybe a better way of dealing with the weight gain.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that happens is that sometimes midlife women somehow believe that they can't be as active, or it's not something becoming of growing older. There are a lot of reasons. Sometimes the demands of being in the sandwich generation, you're taking care of younger people, older people, you just don't have time for yourself. And we have to realize that it's critical to make that time, even if we want to be caregivers for others, because if our health deteriorates, we can't be there for someone else. So it's important for other people in our lives that we take care of our own bodies and that we find time to relax, take a hot bath, that we take brisk walks or do anything physical that we enjoy. Women often find that that's the way to combine socializing with physical activity. Take a brisk walk with a friend, play tennis, whatever you like.
You know, I wanted to ask you something also. I mean, this book is really chock full of a whole lot of wonderful suggestions, many more than we have time to cover today. So I wanted to turn to another aspect, and that just the aspect of writing a book collaboratively.
Well, each one of us comes to doing this work on a different trajectory. I was thinking I was headed for medical school, and it's a long story I can't tell right now, but I ended up not going on to graduate school. I ended up joining this group at a very young age, and I am largely self-educated, working with people in the research field and people who have followed many of these issues in various contexts and settings. And so my information does not come from a particular course or degree. It comes from these, you know, 36 years of working in this field. But there are other women who came to this work from an experience at Planned Parenthood or taking a public health course or getting a master's in public health, having a family member deal with a crisis that did not involve very good response by the medical providers that they had, and so they educated themselves and found out how critically important it is for consumers to know a certain amount. And this is not to say that providers are universally bad or inconsiderate, but in the era of managed care, many of these providers can't spend the time they'd like to spend with their patients. So it really does make sense to be as well informed as you can be, so that when you have those precious 10 or 15 minutes, you use them well, that you, you know, come with questions already prepared, that you think a little bit about your visit beforehand. And some providers are learning to organize group sessions where, for example, around menopause, women can join in on an evening or a Saturday morning and talk with a group of other women with the provider and discuss these many issues. There are controversies left and right. We didn't even get to osteoporosis and bone thinning, but there too is a medicalization of women's lives that is not appropriate. Most women around midlife do not have to worry about some bone loss, do not have to start taking medications. This notion that osteopenia, this rather dubious categorization of a pre-osteoporotic state, has generated quite a bit of controversy, and many of the academic researchers are urging women actually not to get bone testing and not to take these drugs earlier on. Osteoporosis is something we all need to be thinking about, but it's a major concern for older women, women who are 65 and older, and for those women, many of these interventions have proven their benefit. But for younger women, we actually don't have the kind of proof of benefit that would warrant everybody going without a certain risk factors or problems going on these medications simply because they have this osteopenia diagnosis.
Medications such as?
Oh, medications such as Fosamax, the bisphosphonates, alendronate, and there are others as well. And also hormones. If you take estrogen, you will reduce the rate at which you lose bone density. But we have to remember that our bones are meant to get less dense as we age. They can still be strong. They can still not fracture. There's not a direct correlation between loss of bone mass and likelihood of fracture. It's a much more complicated story. And as we use some of these medications for longer periods, we learn, for example, that the kind of bone that Fosamax helps a woman build up might be more brittle, might in fact be more likely to fracture. And in rare cases, we have now identified a kind of deterioration of the jaw that occurs with Fosamax use. So these are all things women have to read about, learn about, and make an informed decision on.
What about taking calcium, and what about exercise?
Well, there's no question. Exercise is great for so many things, and weight-bearing exercise is certainly good for keeping your bones healthy. But you need not just calcium, and I think we may be overdoing the amount of calcium we're recommending, and that's an interesting controversy. But you also need vitamin D in order to synthesize it properly, and you need to have magnesium. And these are all issues that are well-defined. You can find information at our website, ourbodiesourselves.org. You can find some of this in our books. But it's also an area where it makes sense to go to some of the nutritional experts if you really want to get in-depth information.
Well, the book is Our Bodies, Ourselves, Menopause by the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. And Judy Norsegian, thank you so much for talking to us about this wonderful book and continuing to write these wonderful books.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to join you.
Judy Norsegian talking about Our Bodies, Ourselves, Menopause. You're listening to Writer's Voice. Stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Andrew Weil after the break.